Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, August 29, 2013, if you've got the time. I've got the news and the comments. Here in California, fires are spreading.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you fire. I'll send you to
burn. And I can hear Pat Robertson saying that God is punishing California for marriage equality. Hundreds of thousands of acres of forest land in the center of California have been burning for days, an area larger than the city of Chicago. And it continues to burn. They claim the fire is now about 23% contained, and they hope that by September the 10th, they will have it fully under control. And we have conditions that are ripe for wildfires. And the problems have been compounded by the federal budget cuts driven by the madness of sequestration. And specifically, Senator Boxer of California has pointed out that we would have had more firefighters, more equipment, and more aircraft to attack these blazes. There are more than 4,000 firefighters on the front lines, and lots of aerial resources are being used. But it spread quickly and got way out of control. And it is threatening parts of the treasured Yosemite National Park. It is moving eastward into the park, where they have launched some backfires to try to limit the scope of it. And as you may know, San Francisco gets its water supply from a flooded valley and reservoir system just north of Yosemite called Hetch Hetchy. And so far, there has been no interruption in water service. A lot of that water gets pumped to holding tanks closer to San Francisco. And there have been some concerns about the fire ash, getting into the water supply and tainting it. And they normally don't filter the water from Hetch Hetchy because it's so pure. And they are planning to put some filter systems in, probably something a little more complicated than the Brita filter in your kitchen. Well, the good news today is that I can eat my words from yesterday. So far, the United States has not launched a military assault on Syria. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, I'd like to thank the people who support my work here at peterbcollins.com with their subscriptions, people from all over the country and around the world. And I am grateful for the support that I get. I want to identify Walter J. Damkowski III, Wally D., who signed up for an annual subscription yesterday. Thank you, Wally. You can also support us by doing your web business with GoDaddy.com. I found out today, just in my general reading, that GoDaddy is the largest single domain name operator in the world. And they have great customer service. And their size is one of the reasons why they can deliver great product at low cost. Like their $1.99 a month web hosting plan with unlimited storage and bandwidth. And they'll bonus you your domain name at no charge. To get a special deal that supports the Peter B. Collins Show, follow the GoDaddy link in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Well, yesterday, despite the fact that most of the media attention was focused on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech, and the president was there to participate, there was a long-scheduled interview with the Public Television NewsHour. And it was quite a lengthy interview, and they allowed the president to talk quite a bit about Dr. King, his legacy, the president's speech. But they appropriately opened with some relatively tough questioning for the PBS team of the president about his intentions towards Syria and asking for proof about the so-called evidence that he says shows that the Syrian government bears responsibility for this attack. A quote from his interview, "We have concluded that the Syrian government in fact carried these out. And if that's so, then there need to be international consequences." Now, the president was cool and cerebral. He displayed his in-depth knowledge of the region and of the ill effects of the actions that he is contemplating. And this is a real change because up until now, for the most part, the president has not really spoken much publicly or entertained questions about Syria. when he acquiesced to the humanitarian hawks in his administration and announced that we would provide some military aid to the so-called rebels in Syria, he allowed a junior staffer on the National Security Council, Ben Rhodes, to make that announcement. So I give the president some due there, but he's not listening to the American public. And his desire to essentially not look bad because he claimed that if gas was used in Syria, it would cross a red line that would trigger American action. Well, now he's kind of stuck. And it's really troubling to see a guy who is so smart succumb to that Washington mentality that currently is not shared by most members of Congress or even the top leaders of our military. And before we move on from the PBS interview, I do give Judy Woodruff and Gwen Ifill some credit for pressing the question on questions to the president on certain issues. But the glaring omission was they didn't raise anything about the NSA, the summer of leaks, anything related to those issues. And, of course, one of the premises of the secret proof the White House says it has about Syria's use of chemical weapons is based on reported intercepted communications between commanders in Syria, and that's attributed to Israel's intelligence operation. And so the president is saying that he is now going to brief congressional leaders. But the latest story from the New York Times today is headlined, Obama is willing to go it alone in Syria, aides say. Now this follows a stunning rebuke in the Parliament of England, where a vote was narrowly defeated, a bill was narrowly defeated to support Prime Minister Cameron's desire to join the U.S. adventure. And it was a 285 to 272 vote in the Parliament. So that is remarkably close, given at least the polling that we're seeing in the U.S. and abroad on this prospect of a military assault on Syria. Activists in the United States, by the way, are gearing up, and I've seen email and Facebook traffic about plans for a big protest this Saturday. And I encourage you to participate if there's any way you can, if there is a march or a rally near you. And I'll try to update you in tomorrow's news and comment if I can get more details about this. So given that we've got a UN Security Council that essentially will not take action in the face of a threatened Russian veto, France is dialing back. Prime Minister Hollande, no, he's a president, I'm sorry, President Hollande, has said that he will now wait for evidence coming from the UN weapons inspectors who are in Syria, and we are learning that they are going to leave Damascus a day early on Saturday. So this creates the prospect that the U.S. may operate alone, that the president may confer with congressional leaders, as is supposed to happen Thursday night. But while we're barbecuing on Labor Day, we may be roasting Damascus or other points in Syria with missile strikes launched from the Mediterranean. And I hope that this is delayed, if not completely canceled, because I think it's sheer madness. The idea that we can spank Bashar Assad without moving toward what they call regime change means that this is just a show of force. And likewise, the situation there is so fluid, so chaotic, that the idea of inserting a new violent, aggressive player in this civil war is just ludicrous. And it risks the unknown consequences of blowback and retaliation that could come from Iran, from Hezbollah, and even from Russia and China in ways that you and I can't currently imagine. And so Obama's got to be a pretty lonely guy right now as he looks at this situation. And I hope that he's going to listen more to even members of his own party. Bob Menendez, the tainted senator from New Jersey, says, you know, it's really a question of whether or not you send an international message that weapons like chemical weapons can't be used, but he is very cautious about this. And here's a guy to watch, Chris Murphy, a freshman senator from Connecticut, who's on the Foreign Relations Committee. He questioned whether chemical weapons attacks in Syria constitute an imminent threat to U.S. interests. And that was a point the president tried to make in his PBS interview, that by crossing this line into the use of chemical weapons, that this somehow offends the national interest of the United States. And I know in some ways it's tawdry to parse these things as people are dying. And I watched Al Jazeera America last night. That was my first take on the news. And it was interesting because Al Jazeera, its main network in the Middle East, has been dinged for its one-sided coverage of Syria, because the funders of Al Jazeera in the Emirates of Qatar are actively funding some of the so-called rebels in Syria. And it was interesting because the Al Jazeera broadcast had no people opposed to a U.S. strike, at least on the iWatch for a full hour. They even trotted out a very young, she seemed under 30, representative of a right-wing think tank who was interviewed for 4 or 5 minutes and saying that, we should have intervened a long time ago. And I hope that cooler heads will prevail, and that Obama doesn't feel the need to assuage his own ego because he drew a line and then didn't hold to it. To its credit, CNN reported yesterday on an item that I mentioned in our news and comment. That is the hypocrisy of the United States related to chemical weapons. The CNN report, 6 minutes long, goes into detail about the birth defects of children born in Fallujah since we almost leveled that town back in 2003-2004. And we used white phosphorus liberally. It was called shake and bake by the troops. We know that. We also used weapons with depleted uranium on the rounds. And now the birth defects are showing. One toddler who was profiled has 6 fingers and 6 toes and can barely function. Her brother died shortly after birth from complications. And the CNN report shows there are no statistics, no studies, no effort to investigate that might connect this wave of birth defects in Iraq with American weaponry, including chemical weapons. I want to commend my colleague and friend, Sabelle Edmonds, the publisher of Boiling Frogs Post, and I'm going to put up a link in my show file to Sabelle's latest article, which recaps Boiling Frogs Post coverage of the events in Syria, going all the way back to the fall of 2011, when Sabelle first reported, based on her sources in the region, that U.S. troops were laying the groundwork to force Bashar al-Assad out of power in Syria. I recommend you read that. And while you're at Boiling Frogs Post, watch either the highlight clip or the full interview that James Corbett has posted in the last couple of days with a French-Syrian woman named Aysar Madani. Now, make no bones about it. Madani is a supporter of the Assad government. But I think it's really important for us to hear the perspective of someone on the ground in Syria who supports her government, who refers to the rebels, rebels, as jihadists, most frequently. And she asserts that based on satellite imagery, there is proof that it's the rebels and not the Syrian military that have used gas or chemical weapons. And again, I can't vouch for everything that Isar Madani says. And some of it actually made me cringe because she, in some ways, kind of laughs at the people dying as she defends the Assad government. But I think James Corbett has done an excellent job and a much-needed role to bring us other points of view outside the stenographic corporate media in this country. Another item related to Boiling Frogs Post, yours truly, is launching a new podcast series that will appear weekly at Boiling Frogs Post. We've named the new show Processing Distortion, and in the first episode, I have a lengthy conversation with Norman Solomon. He's an activist and an author. He wrote the book War Made Easy, How Politicians and Pundits Spin Us Into War. And he offers some very clear critical comments of the Obama administration and the media for the way this is being spun up and the way important facts like evidence are being soft-pedaled or pushed back in favor of this kind of propaganda effort. So I hope you will check that out. And one more item from Boiling Frogs Post and James Corbett. Today I released an in-depth interview podcast at peterbcollins.com with Richard Gage, AIA, and Pamela Senzi. Gage is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And together with Senzi, they describe the Rethink 9/11 media campaign, which is underway and will build between now and September 11th. And on 9/11, there's going to be a vigil in Times Square in New York City at 5:20 in the afternoon. Why 5:20? Because that's the time when Building 7 came down in its own footprint, in a free fall, clearly detonated. And of course, Building 7 wasn't hit by an airplane. It was the site of the command center for the CIA for emergency services in New York City. And it is kind of the crowbar being used to open people's minds about what is believed to be the controlled demolition of the Twin Towers. Now, I consider myself relatively fearless on this, and I know that many of my friends and colleagues think I am crazy. But I do not believe the official narrative of 9/11 as put forward by our government and our media and whitewashed by the 9/11 Commission. And I encourage you to listen to the in-depth interview with Richard Gage and Pamela Senzi. Here's an excerpt from that conversation as Richard Gage talks about how hard it is to get people to focus on the evidence because our emotions often get in the way.
We're talking about 2,000 architects and engineers, technical, credible professionals who are placing their reputations on the line. We're talking about 200 firefighters who are considered heroes now by the American people because of their bravery, placing their credibility on the line. So that's what we're putting before the American people throughout these 11 cities that we're targeting now, and that number of cities will grow in phase two of our campaign. We have big plans. We're trying to go to $500,000 campaign following the September successes, which we fully expect. We will be gathering in Times Square on the 11th of the month, September 11th, at 5:20, because 5:20 is the time this Building 7 dropped like a rock into its own footprint.
You can hear the full interview with Richard Gage and Pam Senzi. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And I open the podcast with the audio from James Corbett's powerful 5-minute video, which compresses all of the issues of 9/11, the contradictions, the inaccuracies, the reports that don't square with basic physics. And I'm also putting up a link to that video so you can watch it with the pictures on your own computer. I consider it a must-see. The summer of leaks continues. Today it was the turn of the Washington Post to publish information provided by Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. and Barton Gellman, who has this unusual position. Bart used to work for the Post, and now he's doing contract work. He was approached by representatives of Snowden and given some of the same information that Glenn Greenwald got. And so Bart Gellman and the Washington Post are showing some cojones. They have published information from the so-called black budget, the secret budget used in the whole spook community. Let me give you some highlights. Last year, this current fiscal year, ending September 30th, the total black budget was $52.6 billion. About $15 billion of that went to the CIA. And to be fair, while there is some courage being shown here as the Graham family gets ready to hand over the Washington Post to Jeff Bezos, the Amazon billionaire, they're still filtering this information. The Washington Post is withholding, it says, some information after consultation with U.S. officials because of concerns about the risk to intelligence sources and methods. So we're not getting the full picture. This is limited hangout. But it still is fascinating, and it's important for Americans to know. We've spent more than $500 billion, that's $500 billion, on intelligence since 9/11. You feel safer? You feel $500 billion safer? Well, I don't. So in addition to the $52 billion in the black budget, there's another $23 billion devoted to intelligence programs at the Pentagon. So that pushes the total up to $75 billion. NSA gets about $10.5 billion of that. The National Reconnaissance Office, you barely know about that, right? NRO gets $10.3 billion. CIA gets 28% of the total budget. And the CIA allocates $2.3 billion for human intelligence, that's spies. And $68.6 million is earmarked for creating and maintaining cover, the front organizations and false identities that our spies use to do their trade. Now, I mentioned Bart Gellman. I've interviewed him once. He wrote a book about Cheney called The Angler. Interesting guy, very smart. Very much an inside-the-beltway player. A guy who knows the value of access. So you don't step on the toes of your sources because you want them to talk to you in the future. But Bart Gellman recently refused to knuckle under to White House demands, and I give him and the Post important kudos for this. The issue arose when Gellman interviewed the NSA's director of compliance, a guy named John DeLong. It's reported that DeLong answered questions freely in a 90-minute interview. And then when Gellman wrote up the story and quoted him, the White House said, nope, you can't use any of those quotes. Negotiations followed as Gellman tried to collaborate a little bit and scrub the quotes. The White House kept saying no, and so he said, F you. And we need more news organizations and reporters to do that, because the Obama White House is extremely controlling. They try to demand that, in order to quote somebody, you have to write the story and submit it to them for approval. It's not good enough for them that you tape recorded it or that you're a good stenographer at the time of the interview. Everybody else adheres to that standard, but the Obama White House pushes it to a new high. And when you couple that with the claims of transparency that the administration falsely makes, and the limited access that reporters have to Barack Obama. He's given exactly one interview that I'm aware of to the New York Times since he became president in 2009. Whatever you think of the Times, it is the best national paper, a newspaper of record. And he'd rather do a 5-minute shot with an anchor in Des Moines than sit down with the people who know a lot more, say, at the New York Times. Good news today, two men are going home from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, finally. Now the count is reduced to 164 men being held there. Two Algerians, Nabil Saeed Hadjarab, age 34, and Mutia Sadiq Ahmad Sayeb, age 37, were shown to the gate at Guantanamo earlier today. I hope they fly them home to Algeria. I don't know the exact protocol. The last guy to be released was young Omar Khadr, who was flown to Canada, where he is still in custody. And this finally shows some follow-through of the president's expression of a desire to get rid of the inmates who've been cleared for release at Guantanamo and eventually shut the damn place down. Today, the Obama administration said it will not sue to undo laws legalizing marijuana in 20 states, although it will monitor operations in those states to make sure they don't run afoul of several enforcement priorities, like marijuana sales to children, illegal cartel activity, interstate trafficking, and violence and accidents involving the drug. Now, here in California, we're kind of sensitive about this because Obama promised that he would not go out of his way to crack down on medical marijuana clinics here in the Golden State. And time for his reelection campaign last year, he reversed. And it's been a brutal crackdown on these clinics that operate under state law. The feds deny them their tax status, and so they're not allowed to deduct anything from the revenues that they generate, and therefore they're supposed to pay tax on 100% of their income. They've used every technique, hitting landlords to prevent them from leasing space to medical marijuana dispensaries. And so I'm happy for Colorado and Washington State, but we have to see a real clear change from the Holder Justice Department, particularly when it comes to medical pot. And as I've said the last couple of days, we need to reclassify weed. It is not a Schedule I drug. Major Nidal Hassan was convicted last week and yesterday was sentenced to death for the killing spree that left 13 dead and more than 31 people injured in November 2009 at Fort Hood. Not a surprise, but such a weird case where he was allowed to defend himself and then put on no defense. And I know he wants to be a martyr, and that's why he engineered it that way, but I'm still opposed to the death penalty, even in a clear-cut case here of a wanton killer. A coalition of more than 100 environmental and political activist groups here in California are demanding that Governor Jerry Brown put a halt to fracking. And after our conversation with Ken Jones the other day, I did place a call to Sacramento to the governor's office and asked, well, I told the guy, my comment is I want the governor to put a moratorium on fracking. And the governor's been kind of slippery on this. He seems to think fracking's okay and that expanding oil production in California is good for the economy. But I hope he'll take a closer look. Meanwhile, the Senate Bill 4, the only surviving legislation from the process this year that is a weak effort to put some controls on fracking and require disclosures of the chemical cocktails that are used, it's still dangling in Sacramento, and the San Francisco Chronicle has endorsed its passage. The other battle in the state capitol here is over reducing the population of the state prison system as ordered by federal courts. The deadline is the end of this year. Governor Brown has been posturing in ways that really offend me, because there are clear ways that he could reduce the prison population by early release, by releasing life prisoners over the age of 60. There are thousands of them. And he refuses to do it. And I remember an interview I did with Jerry Brown when he was out of office in the 1990s. He talked about running for the Senate seat that Dianne Feinstein has held since 1992. And I said, well, what would you do to win that race? And he said, oh, you just grab a couple of issues and demagogue them. He actually said that. And I believe he is demagoguing prisons and the prisoners right now, because he wants to be seen as the guy who said, don't make me let more people out of California prisons. You're going to have to make me do it. Well, now there is a split among the Democratic leaders. The state Senate leader, Daryl Steinberg, has rejected Brown's proposal to spend $730 million, which is two-thirds of the budget set aside, that the reserve fund that we've managed to generate since Schwarzenegger spent all of our money, Brown is proposing to rent private prisons from Corrections Corporation of America at the cost of $730 million over the next 2 years. He doesn't have to waste that money. And so I give Steinberg a lot of credit. He says that in his chamber, this plan would not be approved by the Democratic-controlled Senate. And because there was a comment from Don Spector of the Prison Law Office, which supported Steinberg over Brown and the Speaker of the Assembly, John Perez, Brown issued a statement saying, "It would not be responsible to turn over California's criminal justice policy to inmate lawyers who are not accountable to the people. That is bullshit, and that's demagoguery. Nobody is suggesting that this be turned over to inmate lawyers. All we're saying is you don't have to squander the money on for-profit prisons simply to duck the court order to reduce the prison population." And in the Chronicle today, Van Jones co-authored a piece with Matt Haney dinging the governor for his misguided private prison proposal. I'll put up a link to that. It's worth reading. Last item from California today, fast food workers at a number of different outlets are going on strike today. They want to be paid $15 an hour to slang burgers and deliver your supersized fries and soda. And my heart goes out to these people. They have absolutely zero protection from employer retaliation for calling in sick or taking the day off today. There's a rally in Oakland later today at the Coliseum. The targeted restaurants, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Bell, Pizza Hut, Burger King, Chick-fil-A. I don't patronize any of those places, so it's not hard for me to boycott them today, but if you've got a Burger Jones, go home and make one of your own, okay? And finally today, I want to say goodbye to John J. Gilligan. Jack Gilligan served as the governor of Ohio for a single term. He also served in Congress for one term. And he was a classmate of my father's at St. Xavier High School in the class of 1939. I was never terribly close to Jack Gilligan. I had a crush on his daughter Ellen in grade school. But Jack was a real leader, a charismatic guy, a true liberal in a very red state, and a man that I deeply admired. You may know that he was part of the only father-daughter duo of governors in American history. His daughter is Kathleen Sebelius, who is Obama's Secretary of Health and Human Services and was the governor of Kansas when Obama appointed her. The Gilligan family had a successful funeral home business in Cincinnati, and all of my ancestors have been buried by the Gilligans. And now it's Jack's turn to ride in one of those hearses with Gilligan on the side, and I salute him for his service. Even into his late 80s, he continued to serve on the Board of Education in Cincinnati. Very cool guy. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment. This is the free podcast. You're authorized to ship it far and wide, all around the world.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until